Thank you so much for a fantastic open line. I really, really enjoy it. I feel like playing the tune for Golden Girls, eh? Thank you for being a friend, or Ebony and Ivory. Here's the thing. We're allowed to disagree, people, without hating each other and without thinking that the one day when we disagree on an issue, as Sureshini has said, that suddenly you're going to fall out of love with one of your faves. No. I mean, I think what would be weird is if we agreed on everything all the time. That would be what's strange, because we just have different values, principles, lived experiences, academic backgrounds, places where we lived, and all of these things shape how we experience the world, how we see the world, how we read a novel, how we interpret laws, how we think about politics. It would be very weird if we agreed all the time. And in many ways, our open line is the perfect segue into our second hour topic, because I think one of the things that we are still struggling with in social media in particular is what to do with people who disagree with ourselves. And I came across, courtesy Jacques Rousseau, a wonderful article. The headline, I don't want to get bogged down on it. Someone criticized it on Facebook. The article itself is excellent. I've put it on Facebook, on Twitter. I retweeted it this morning. If you haven't seen it, have a look at it after this hour, because you don't want to miss any of this conversation with Jacques. But it is entitled, Social Media is Making Us Dumber. Here's Exhibit A. And I think in between our substantive debates about the economy, about politics, it's useful to sometimes step back and say, by the way, what is the quality of our dialogue? And we've had this conversation a couple of times. You'll remember many discussions with Jacques we've had on the show about particular aspects of dialogue, where hopefully we can sharpen our ability to then come back the next day and not talk about talking, but get on with better quality talking, as it were. We once talked, for example, about anecdotal evidence. What is its place in dialogue, in public discourse? And today, I want to ask about social media. Does it make us dumber? We're going to start with that question and then obviously unravel it. And as always, Jacques is very generous with his time as a friend of the show. He's a lecturer in critical thinking and ethics at the University of Cape Town and so much more. Jacques, thanks so much for coming on the show again.
Pleasure, Eusebius. Good morning.
What's there in your throat? Is that a frog?
It's gone. It was brief. Brief hesitation.
I don't even know where we're going to start with this one. Firstly, thank you for that article that you flagged. You always have a fascinating and generous set of articles that you curate on your social media pages, not just your own work, but that of other people. Maybe a good starting point is just to perhaps share with readers what the context was of this particular article, and then we'll get into the workshopping elements of this discussion, as it were.
Sure. So Steven Pinker, who I'm sure many listeners will know as a esteemed psychologist at Harvard, who's also written very compelling works on violence, and he claims it's declined in modern society, but the data is are disputed. Anyway, this was a panel discussion in which he made some remarks about how a kind of cosseting of sensibilities on campuses and a reluctance to talk about controversial issues can contribute to the growth of the so-called alt-right. And in the course of his, I think, 8 minutes or so of remarks, he used some inflammatory examples. So, for example, saying that it shouldn't be controversial to say that over time various different race groups have been more responsible for violence. So he says that, but then later on he makes the point that this doesn't necessarily mean that it's always the same group. It can be conservative Irish people in some part of history, etc. So he used examples to make the point that if you just react with outrage rather than thinking about things in a historical context, you can get a false impression, and that can feed into your biases and turn you into one of these so-called alt-right people. So the claim of the article author was that the internet is making us, or the social media are making us, dumber because we just take a snapshot of something and react based on that rather than the full picture.
So let's start with the first big question then, and I'll put it pointedly, and then we can get into the complexities. Is social media then making us stupid, or is social media simply amplifying stupidity, intolerance, and other intellectual vices that have been there all along but simply didn't have as much opportunity to travel?
Yeah, so this is a fascinating thing, because for those of us who care about considered and nuanced discourse on the internet can very easily contribute to our own bias of thinking that social media are making us dumber if we misread what's going on there. So if we just look at the voices and the voices that are yelling at us, you can easily just get disgusted or disappointed and walk away thinking there are so many idiots out there. But the more complicated story might be to do with the fact that people have got more access than ever, and it might be to do with the fact that people who feel strongly about a topic are always going to be more likely to contribute to it. So unless you know what the, in a sense, the population size is, you can't really do much about what, you can't really know much about what proportion of them are saying the idiotic things. So are the inflammatory voices or inflamed voices just better represented, is another way of putting it, or are they larger in an absolute sense? Are there more of them? The problem is that public platforms like Twitter and Facebook used to, I mean, A, they didn't exist, but B, people who had influence in public discourse used to get there through some kind of gatekeeping mechanism. You'd have degrees, or you'd be a president, or you'd be a talk show host, or whatever it might be. Whereas now anybody who just shouts a lot and says outrageous things can suddenly have a million Twitter followers and be perceived as influential.
But you know what I often wonder, though, is that that is absolutely true, but we never spoke about how gatekeeping worked before the advent and the proliferation of social media platforms. So if we take, for example, Jacques, let's just say, like, you know, a simple example, the letters pages of the newspapers. If Jacques Rousseau has a show on Cape Town, or let's say, I don't know, let's take John in the afternoons on Cape Talk. If there's a letters pages editor who just hates him because he's too clever for their liking, they might gatekeep all the praise that John is getting when someone writes to a newspaper and says, I just love this guy. I wish every other host was as clever as John Maytham. And then the one person Eusebius writes in and says, John is arrogant and intolerant. And now you decide to use your discretionary power in the hard copy of the newspaper to publish that one piece. It quickly can become gospel. Next thing, you have the managers thinking, geez, did you see, and say to their colleagues in management, did you see what is on page 6 of the Cape Argus? And next thing, John is called in. So the point that I'm trying to make is that while we criticize the self-congratulation, the echo chambers on Twitter, how we collate friends that agree with us, Jacques and Tom having a bit of a laugh at each other on each other's Facebook walls, how much of this was absent before social media? There was gatekeeping all along as well.
This is a very important point. There always was, but to further the point that you were making, the gatekeeping could play an even more insidious role than what you're talking about, because as one would expect, it would have privileged certain classes and certain races, and not just certain personalities and individuals. Yes. So we've always had that. But the problem that we need to address or grapple with now is that of a potential overcompensation to that, right? Okay. So the fact that the power might have been distributed, the power to speak might have been distributed unequally, doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't virtue or value in some kind of curation, right? It should just be more objectively applied. And an entirely separate question is whether we can do that, whether there are mechanisms to do that. But the nexus issue I'm just raising is that it doesn't obviously make sense to say that because we used to do this badly and continue doing it badly, we should do none of it now at all.
Okay, so if I understand you correctly, Jacques, and correct me if I'm wrong, what you're saying is that, okay, sure, Peter Bruce or Eusebius McKeyser can no longer stop someone from publishing a disagreeable viewpoint because they can simply start a blog, go on Facebook, on Twitter, or YouTube channel. And that's a good thing, because now we are democratizing the space for dialogue. But the downside is that we are democratizing, and it also means that there's a downside to not having any kind of gatekeeping, which is that you can have fake news, for example. You can have attacks. You can have people being hounded away from the marketplace of ideas because of the tonality of speech as well. Is that the point? Is that what you mean by overcorrecting?
Yeah, I do mean that, and I also mean the slide into a kind of perhaps relativistic idea that just because we can all speak all views should be treated equally. So we still need to pay attention to authority and credibility and so forth, but we need to somehow try to find mechanisms for not vesting that in arbitrary notions like what language you speak or what color of your skin is and those sorts of things. And as I say, it's a long-term project, right? We're only discovering what the problems of social media are now, because it's such a new thing. And as the other fascinating piece that you and I both read yesterday and today in Wired magazine pointed out, is that it's not simply the part I've raised so far, that you can gain a large audience through being abusive or trolly or loud or whatever it might be. The second thing is that what bubbles into our consciousness, into our filter bubble, is often driven by advertising revenue decisions, right? So what Facebook decides to promote might be to do with what gets the most clicks, and that then comes onto your feed more likely than something else. So it's not, you see something coming up all the time, and I think your instinctive reaction is to say, oh, this must be important, this must be interesting.
Yes.
But meanwhile, it's just a consequence of ad revenue.
Absolutely, and I want to come back to that in a second. It's 18 minutes after 10. If you're listening to this conversation, I want you to answer some of these following questions for me as honestly as you possibly might. And it's a safe space. Let's be clear. Jacques himself, and Jacques is honest to a fault about these kinds of things, even as a specialist in critical thinking. Even as someone who might tutor or teach informal logic or argumentation, it doesn't mean that you yourself don't commit some of these vices. It takes constant reminder, practice, self-examination, and asking your friends and colleagues to correct you when you are also making the same kinds of bad moves in conversation with other people, right? So the first question, who do you follow on social media? Do you, by and large, engage and follow and retweet people that are like-minded, who think like you, or do you actually follow people who disagree with you? And how diverse, really, are the number of Facebook posts and debates that you engage and the people that you follow? Let's just be honest about it. I'd love to know what your behavior is. Do you get irritated with people who fundamentally disagree with you online? Do you end up blocking them, muting them, not following them? And do you, by and large, engage the people who have similar worldviews as yourself? And please don't lie about it. It's tempting to lie and pretend that you are virtuous. And I think we could all do better. I'm just sincerely interested in what your habits are. And maybe you've never thought about it before. Give it a couple of seconds of thought. Think about the people that you follow on Twitter. And tell me how diverse, truly, your Twitter timeline is. 011-883-0702. That's the number here in Johannesburg and in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. We're in conversation with critical thinking lecturer Jacques Rousseau. And I think, Jacques, on the other side of this break, let's talk a little bit about tonality. One of the poisonous things about social media is that we might be scared to express our disagreement because someone will come back and whack you over the head. 23 minutes after 10, we're talking about social media and critical dialogue. Does it, in certain respects, dumb down the ways in which we engage one another? John in Midrand, thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you for a great show again. I always try and schedule my driving when you're on the radio. and I find sometimes your views, you know, really get me riled up, and then sometimes I agree. I'd like to phone in and agree with you. But this is a great show. If I could just say, I find personally that I'm a great follower of Twitter. I'm not a Facebooker. My personal experience is not that I feel it makes me any dumber or smarter, but it's heightened a different part of my psyche, and that's the spectrum of gullible to skeptical. And so I find myself quite confused many times between should I take for face value and granted what I've just read, and then I'm able to react with some sensibility, or do I just remain completely skeptical and write it off? And I get that wrong more times than I get it right. And I think that's a slightly different set of social media dynamic for me.
Yes, absolutely. And before we get to tone, Jacques, that second article you put up yesterday from Wired was so on point. I mean, it was just so layered. And one of the issues it discusses, doesn't it, is precisely John's point. And you've touched one element firstly, which is the idea that more speech, as in just lots and lots and lots of speech, somehow is the hallmark of commitment towards free speech. But let's put that aside for one second. And then there is, of course, this thing that we've seen play out, particularly with elections around the world, where a certain kind of skepticism we know, trained in philosophy, is not a bad thing with which to move through the universe. But there are also people who benefit from a crippling kind of skepticism that can result because of the spread of fake news. If someone is never ever going to have any faith in argumentation and evidence, then we also have a problem.
Yeah, precisely. And just as a brief thing about the fake news, just coming in now to the studio, I read a new survey in the New York Times that 42% of Republicans view just negative reporting automatically as fake news, right? So it's not the fact that there's anything false, it's just that it's negative. But yeah, as John rightly points out, and as you've said now, the plethora of viewpoints and the disagreement amongst those viewpoints, especially when something becomes a trend on Twitter and you get bombarded by different views, and they might be from influential people on both sides, and you suddenly don't know what to think. And the response to that ideally would be a reminder that it's so important to go back to primary sources and look at the data and figure it out for yourself. But because we don't have the time for that, many of us don't have the time for that, we instead kind of fall into this kind of crippling postmodern view that there's no way of knowing the truth. And I think that might incentivize us to just pick a side and start dogmatically defending that corner rather than understanding that things are contested.
And besides becoming dogmatic as a result, it can also have all sorts of impact socially and politically. Because if I, for example, am stealing, let's say, from the South African taxpayer, I want to continue stealing. I don't need to convince Jacques that I'm innocent. I simply need Jacques to become exasperated with the state of debate about my innocence.
Yeah, no, precisely.
Because if Jacques goes, I really don't know anymore, hey? I really don't know. Is Patricia de Lille innocent? I just can't make up my mind. Well, that is not a neutral consequence of creating a climate of skepticism about evidence.
Yeah, no, precisely. And I mean, perhaps to some extent, that's how we can analyze the Trump phenomenon, is that if you just bombard people with so much noise, it becomes very easy to say, well, you don't know that for sure. I mean, there was all this other data which tells you something else. So who knows?
Absolutely. Pumlani, good morning to you.
Good morning, Eusebius, and to your guest, Jacques, and to all the listeners. My viewpoint in this is I disagree with the headline of the article as much as I have.
We just lost Pumlani there. We'll see whether we'll get him back. Let's talk a little bit about tone, Jacques. One of the things that put people off about either social media completely or certain parts of social media where otherwise you might be able to have a wonderful overlapping consensus, disagreement here and there, interesting dialectic on complex issues from race to politics, it's just the tone with which we engage each other.
It is indeed. And I mean, back to your letters to the editor comment earlier on, it's a useful thing to perhaps remind ourselves that we wouldn't, in those days, we wouldn't have fired things off in such an intemperate and hostile fashion if we had time to sit and consider and reflect and write something down. There's a lovely Theodore Dalrymple essay called Thank You for Not Expressing Yourself, which makes this point at length and in very amusing fashion. But yeah, so we forget that we are talking to other human beings sometimes, and especially if we're talking about anonymous accounts, I think they often are formed for the exact purpose of just being abusive in a sense. But I think people should remind themselves of just basic social etiquette sometimes, and would I say this to that person's face? But something about the distance, the psychological distance of being behind a screen, I think makes it easier for us to be more hostile and critical than we'd be in person.
I suppose what exacerbates it, and emoticons, an attempt to try and deal with this, right, but it's still imperfect. It's very difficult to convey tone in text alone. I ticked off someone that I really, really like, that I respect deeply as a journalist, and I think it was the phrase, well, I want to keep it real, and in their head it came across as I know better than you, and it's not quite what I meant. So it's also difficult to if we are generous about some of the tone clashes that we have on social media, sometimes it's difficult to convey your intention, and how your words are received is not always up to you.
Yeah, I saw that exchange. I think you were just having a grumpy day, weren't you? But it's very difficult to convey. But also, the audience needs to understand that thing called the fundamental attribution error, and that basically means not.
What is that? It sounds very brainy.
So it means just not imputing the worst possible motive to somebody when you view their words. To remember that we speak in different phrases and tonations and whatever. So when you see the words, try to think of different interpretations for them and what the most charitable one might be rather than the most negative one.
Okay, I want to come back to that after the news headlines. But Tara's here. It's Half Past 10 years, the latest in EWN headlines. 28 minutes before 11, if you just joined us, we're having a really cool conversation about whether social media makes us dumber. And in the details of this conversation, we're talking about how intolerant we sometimes are towards each other in terms of not allowing for disagreement online, how we are chasing likes and retweets, and also the present point, the tone with which we sometimes disagree with one another. Jacques, does it take skill and practice to learn to not attribute the worst motives to the person that you are in conversation with?
I'd say it certainly does, but it also takes a commitment to respect and to kind of humanitarian treatment of other people. So in other words, a concern or a care for what they believe and for the fact that they might be speaking from an entirely different set of beliefs or experiences or whatever it might be. So we hear the words and just map them against our set of beliefs and then make the judgment of right versus wrong rather than thinking about where they're coming from and trying to find some sort of commonality between them. So you need to, in a sense, adopt that more charitable view. So it takes that empathy, but it also takes, yes, being able to pass and understand the actual content of it. But we're talking about social media, so there are these snippets. They're not fully formed arguments. So if you do care, then you would ask follow-up questions. You'd ask for clarification rather than just make that snap judgment based on the 280 characters.
I read this really cool book last year, which I think you'd enjoy, by the way. The title just eludes me now, but it was about technology addictions that we are not taking sufficiently seriously. And I've got some interesting stuff there about addiction in general, some interesting new theses about the nature of addiction. And along the way, this guy was a South African-born author based in Australia, who then moved to the States. He talks about how incredible the understanding of human psychology is among people who invent and come up with different games that you and I eventually become addicted to, all the classic ones from Super Mario to what have you. And it's amazing how much joy we get out of certain kinds of online affirmation. And so to bring it back to this conversation, we seem to like being liked literally and figuratively. And that makes it very hard to be generous towards Jacques, for example, if in my echo chamber, lashing out against Jacques will get me retweeted, 100 times. And similarly, some of Jacques' friends who can't understand the love affair between Jacques and Eusebius, and if Jacques were to say something really, really nasty about Eusebius, you might get yourself retweeted 100 times. Now, Facebook and Twitter and the people behind it are very, very clever in their understanding of our psychology. They don't introduce these opportunities for us to like and retweet each other just on a whim. They do it because they know that we end up pursuing retweets and liking.
Yes, and excuse me.
And what that does in turn is that I think it sets up a context in which you might remember from your undergrad, you're teaching something called the principle of charity, but online you are just chasing the high. You're chasing the high of constantly getting retweeted or getting liked.
Yeah, precisely. And so as you were saying, the curation by Facebook or Twitter and what comes into your feed is the stuff that's popular or stuff that's getting lots of eyeballs. And if there is a fight between people who are saying outrageous things to each other, people do like to latch onto that bandwagon and show solidarity with the one side rather than the other one. And the problem with this is that a nuanced viewpoint that tries to say, well, I see what you're saying, but you're wrong for these and these reasons, so some attempt to interject some sort of subtlety into the whole thing is not the kind of thing that will gain mass popularity.
Yes.
So we end up exacerbating that polarity because those more temperate remarks just get drowned out by one extremist side or the other extremist side.
Absolutely. Pumlani, I think we've got you on a clearer line now. You didn't like the headline given to this article, but are there other aspects of the details of this discussion or the article that has given you something to chew on?
No. Okay. Thank you, Eusebius, for coming back to me. No, I was saying I didn't read the article, the content, which is not a very wise thing before I have a dissenting opinion. But my opinion is, I think social media has improved the quality of conversation and debate we have, in the sense that we are now able to open up a dialogue that we were previously unable to. For example, on sexism issues or racism issues or any other thing, were easily before social media, in our cocoons and in our small corners, we would discuss sexist ideas with other sexist males, for example, or racist ideas with other racist white or black individuals, or racist, let me put it that way. Now, social media has, in a way, exposed who we are. The only challenge we have is that we don't know how to differ with each other, how to accept that we have different opinions, and it's okay to have a different opinion. And let's put those opinions on the table, let's discuss them, and let's debate them, so that if I'm able to be persuaded to the other side, I can be. And if I'm able to be corrected on my prejudices, I can be corrected. I like how you closed the open line, for example. Point in case. Thank you.
Yeah, you see, Pumlani, I agree with you. We can play, example, table tennis. So what I like about social media, it's not all negative, and you're right, we need to talk about, and I'm going to ask Jacques this question as well, what are the productive aspects of online debate? There must be some, surely. Well, it doesn't have to be, but presumably there are. And the accountability of our viewpoints, I think, is, you're absolutely right. Okay, we've lost Pumlani there. If, you know, I mean, if you use the word dumb, for example, someone else might take that as a teaching moment and explain to you that it's ableist, and suddenly you have to realize that you're not as woke as you thought you was, and you have to rethink casually using a word like dumb, say. But the flip side of it, Jacques, for me, is that at the same time, people also suddenly become very hardened, and there's no opportunity for complexity. And the very idea of nuance and complexity, and I do think sometimes people use that as a cop-out to take a clear view on something that is morally black and white. But sometimes issues are issues that I haven't made my mind up on, and it doesn't seem to me like social media is conducive to me saying, you know what, I'm kind of not sure what I think about EFF in relation to the H&M protest. I'm puzzling through this matter. I hear Eusebius's criticism, but I also feel the pull of this last caller who just called in and talked about the moral defense of violence in destroying institutional racism. I don't know where I'm sitting. And then people will turn around and say, you simply want to have your cake and eat it. You're fence-sitting. Is there space for uncertainty, for puzzling through different parts of an argument? Is there space for saying, I just am not yet convinced by any of the perspectives?
There is, but there should be far more of it. And this is the challenge, I think, is for us to find ways of building those spaces. So back to Pumlani's call, what he said about being exposed to different views and being able to reflect on things, that was the great hope, in a sense, for many of us, of social media. But more and more, I think that isn't the case. So your example, for ableist language, instead of somebody saying, hey Jacques, have you thought about how that might remind somebody who isn't quite comfortable with their the fact that they can't speak, it might make them feel bad or whatever, some kind of polite intervention like that, rather than calling me a name and insulting me for being ableist, right? So the one contributes to discourse, the other one doesn't. And I think we tend to go for the trolley option rather than the discursive option. So let's take an example. So sexism. If we talk about, obviously, that's a moral black and white, that sexism is bad and that sexual abuse is bad. And that's what everyone's talking about now with this Me Too thing. But even within that, compare a Harvey Weinstein case to a Aziz Ansari case. So there's a universal badness of disrespecting volition and treating women as chattel or whatever it might be. But you can make moral arguments inside that between systematic, repeated rape versus a clumsy date where somebody doesn't pick up on obvious signals, but are verbal signals different to nonverbal signals, etc. So there are things to discuss there, even as you agree that it's all wrong. And we lose the ability to do that.
Absolutely.
So one place where we can, so I came across a, I don't know if you know Reddit, but many of your readers would know Reddit. There's a Reddit board called Change My View, and I'd encourage everybody to go look at that, because what you do there, and you can do this anonymously, you say, here is my controversial opinion. And the community, who have strict rules for discourse and charity and politeness, systematically engage with it and try to tell you why you're wrong.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's
have
very
you plugged in some of your libtard beliefs?
I'm too embarrassed to air those in public. You outed me.
Let's go to Somerset West, Jacques. Seth, thank you for calling in.
Morning, Eusebius. Morning, Jacques.
Morning.
Listening to your program, I suddenly realized, or I've been realizing, how social media has changed me to be a better listener rather than a better giver of opinions. And I found that I prefer to engage with people who are less emotive and more factual, because the emotive engagement becomes drivel. You just sling insults at each other, and I tend to stay away from that, and I tend to follow people whom I admire, and one of those is yourself, Eusebius. And what I wanted to say about that is that because of the emotional nature, or the potential emotional nature of Facebook, and the human knee-jerk reaction to get angry, we had an engagement nearly 2 years ago, I think, on Facebook, and for whatever reason, you blocked me. So what I'm trying to say, it's not because you blocked me, what I'm trying to say is that we need, for me, it's taught me how to engage at a better level without being just going for that knee-jerk reaction and just discounting what you're saying because I don't agree with it.
Mm.
So I just want to say I believe in engagement, and I think that we as a species, we as a country of all ages can learn by asking people or to engage with us as unemotively as possible and to do it just factually. And I think that gives us the opportunity to learn.
Okay. I want to separate two things in Seth's intervention, Jacques. I want to set aside, because you and I have spoken about it before, and we can come back to it because we're going to need many conversations on it, the place of emotion in discourse. You know that this is something I feel strongly about. I obviously disagree with Seth on that one. But I want us to talk about a second issue that Seth mentions, and that is the willingness and the skill set, perhaps, that comes with observing rather than simply jumping in, listening rather than simply opining. Does social media tend to encourage us to be poorer listeners than we otherwise might be?
I would say they certainly do. One, for the reason that we've already mentioned this morning, which is the fact that only a selection of things bubble to the surface of your feed. So you view a part as representing the whole. So you might just see the conclusion and not the argument.
Hmm.
So that shows us that it's incumbent on you as the listener, if you are going to intervene, to at least look through the timeline half an hour or whatever back to see how we got to this point. And I think the second thing is that it's such a gratifying thing for us psychologically to express our view, and it's so easy to do in this kind of rapid intervention on Twitter that we don't stop to think about how we sound and how the audience is going to interpret us, right? So we forget that each time we intervene in the public space, we are contributing to our brand, to put it in very rough commercial terms. We're representing ourselves as humans and showing what we're made of, and I think we should pay more attention to how we do that.
We've got 15 minutes left with critical thinking lecturer Jacques Rousseau. And here's a question for you as you're listening to this very useful conversation from him about how to navigate social media. Do you avoid conflict online, or how do you handle conflict? How do you handle conflict in dialogue or when you get attacked? Do you simply opt out do you at some point do what Ta-Nehisi Coates did and decide, you know what, I'm just going to shut down my Twitter account? Or do you go after every opportunity for a tour when you think that someone is just out of line trolling you or saying something with which you genuinely, sincerely disagree? 011-883-0702. Tell us how you experience social media in relation to conflict. And in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. And on the other side of this, we'll get Jacques' reflections on when to
Twitter at UCBS.
11 minutes before 11, and we're talking about whether social media makes us dumber and all the related sub-themes under it. We had a very useful conversation with Huffington Post essayist Pieter du Toit, as well as with activist Zaki Ahmad, about Afrikaans, Jacques. And along the way, one of the things that we explored was why so many people who also speak Afrikaans, for whom Afrikaans matter as a matter of identity, are silent when the likes of Solidariteit and EFRI Forum behave as if they are the exclusive custodians of Afrikaans politically. And then it becomes harder for the rest of us who speak Afrikaans and have different relationships with Afrikaans to try and bat for Afrikaans when so many of our fellow citizens say Afrikaans is simply the language of the oppressor. Now, I'm not going to go online and engage in conflict with EFRI Forum on this point, because it will simply get my blood pressure up and probably neither of us will be persuaded. For yourself, and then more generally, when do you avoid conflict and when do you feel a duty to actually go in there?
I mean, we'd all, I think, love to regard ourselves as people who are willing to stand up for what's right, no matter what the personal cost and how annoying it is and so forth. But it does get exhausting. And as you say, one's blood pressure does rise. And what I've been trying to do is to think about two issues when engaging or not engaging. And the one is whether it's sincere, my engagement is sincere. In other words, I actually do care about trying to reach some sort of resolution or persuade or whatever it might be, or whether it's simply performative. And this comes back to our discussion earlier on about the polarities in social media. I think so much of the engagement is just to signal to my people, whoever my people are, you know, people who are roughly left free speechy kinds of people, that I am in this fight with them, kind of thing. So I don't really care about the conversation I'm having rather than simply the signal that it sends. And I think if you notice yourself doing that, you should regard that as insincere and not do that, because you really are just contributing to exactly the problem we're addressing today of insincere and lower value conversation. And then the second question would be whether it's possible that your intervention here can make any kind of difference, whether it can actually either persuade the person you're talking to or persuade the audience rather than just your particular aspect of the polarity. But the bystanders who are curious about the arguments, can they learn something from this? And if you can't answer either of those questions in the positive, I really think that one should stay out of it because of those blood pressure and time constraints reasons.
You describe yourself as not being less considered, but certainly less patient. What do you mean by that?
So I think that if I did choose to engage, I would be as kind of calm and perhaps too lacking in emotion, as I think we discussed many years ago, that sometimes one does need a bit of fire in the belly, in a sense. I think I would be the same person, but I don't have the patience or the energy. So I far more often just ignore or tune out or mute and so forth, because you kind of learn to identify certain characters who aren't interested in honest discourse. So I'm not patient enough to try to reason myself into their headspace or them into mine.
Nina, good morning to you and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Eusebius, I'm wondering whether we're missing a point about the nature of crowds, the nature of clans, the nature of the violence of clans or crowd behavior, and how that's being exacerbated by social media. For instance, was Facebook responsible for Trump becoming the president of the United States? And, you know, I think this is part of a discussion that actually very much needs to be had, especially as algorithms are actually part of any discussion we have with someone else. In other words, algorithms pick up what happens. They don't say we should be noble, we should have correct communications, we should consider the other. It says this is what is. And algorithms pick up brutality and they pick up planned behavior. And they replicate that and magnify it. So it's a point around that magnification about social psychology being changed by social media and, you know, the net in general. And why we haven't really got to that discussion. Obviously, it is in the arena, but I think we need to be very clear the degree to which we are being manipulated, we're being shoved into our traditional brutal clan behavior, because that was what was identified about how the election happened in the States. That people simply, as your guest has just said, they shut out views that they didn't like and they retreated to very traditional, essentially brutalizing and othering dynamics.
So what is the moral for you, Nina? Hold on, I don't quite understand it. I understand your description of these manipulative processes of information, et cetera, et cetera. What does that mean? What is the so what for social media?
Well, my so what is that I am hearing in this discourse, you know, that we have a my people. In other words, your guest and you and callers have got my people, and my people are people who are not in communication, you want to expand themselves and develop. The truth is that it's not necessarily the true development that is happening at the moment in terms of collective consciousness. So the so what is that actually collectively the instrument of the net may be pushing people to the exact opposite, to becoming, I don't like the word dumber, because I'd rather say more violent and more plan-based in the most brutal way, where one doesn't listen to the other, but one reconfirms one's own position by only going to what is a reconfirmation.
Okay, now I get you. Sure, now I do get you. Jacques, on balance, stepping back from the details of this conversation, is the summating thought from Nina one that resonates with you, or is that too skeptical?
No, it certainly resonates with me to some extent, and I think it's a useful reminder that we should also remember the value of talking to people and reading books and all of those old-fashioned things. And I think a lot of people get all of their news from things like Facebook and Twitter, and the evidence seems to suggest that Russia and Facebook interference were certainly a large part of it, and that is a warning signal to all of us. And the general point I'd also want to make before, just in a big picture sort of way, relates to our conversation, is that I'd want people to think carefully about free speech and how it relates to the social media thing, because we've for a long time thought about more speech being the ideal, that everybody should be able to intervene. And that's true as far as it goes, but we should also remember that better speech is a very important thing to focus on, and a better spread of viewpoints and the best possible exemplars of those viewpoints. So as much as we never want to shut people out of conversations, an entirely separate value, and one that's really, really worth pursuing, is to try to make sure that the best speech is available to everybody to consume and consider.
We only have a minute left. Maybe this is going to be the beginning of a next discussion with you, Jacques. But can you comment lastly for me on empathy? You've made the observation that often the disagreements aren't just about facts, but often we feel as if other people are not hearing us, and there is the danger that social media crowds out empathy.
Yeah, so I mean, since about 2010, I think it was, there was this paper on something called the backfire effect, and it's come under question in more recent years, in the last 2 years, because it's not been replicated as effectively as the authors would have, I'm sure, hoped. But that was the idea that people lash out and entrench their current views when they hear criticism. So their reaction is just to dig their heels in deeper. It does seem to apply in some cases and not in others. But that relates to what we're talking about, is that everybody with a strongly held view feels misunderstood. misunderstood and feels besieged by somebody else on the other side. So you think you're not being listened to, you think you're perhaps being disrespected, and then we become, in a sense, can become as infantile and reactionary as those people criticizing us. So the empathy comes in here to think, what is this? Why does this person believe what they do? Can I understand the emotion and the fear and the hope and the dream behind this false view they have or this bad view they have, and try to find some way into talking to them on a psychological level rather than just fighting with each other?
Jacques, you've been fantastic as always. Thank you so much for making time for us.